Very rarely do I try to, like, you know, go out on my own and create the chavura, but this week it just happened that way. And then I found, like, a nice idea of Rebbe Lam afterwards, so that was beautiful. And then I found a great, great, great idea by Rebbe Tzion Fuhrer, which, God willing, will be next year's chavura, so I don't have to worry about that. The question really is, I want to focus tonight on Yitzhak's blindness and what exactly that means. I'm sure most of us are familiar with Rashi that offers three different explanations on why he's blind. So we're going to kind of take a look at that. That's like the jumping off point, because that Rashi is, it's a little bit difficult why he has to go in three different directions. So I got to use a sefer that I bought when I was in sixth grade because I was doing Chidon HaTanach, and my Chidon HaTanach Rebbe, Rebbe Attic, said I needed it. And I think I've used it twice since the 80s, maybe the early 90s. So because of that, I feel like it's a win. It's the only thing that would tap that is I bought a sefer at the YU Svarim sale for a quarter that I've tried so many times to use for a chabura. I'll be like, it's the best deal ever. I haven't been able to understand it yet, but I refused to part with it when we made Aliyah, even though, I don't understand any of it, because I'm like, one day, my Hebrew is going to be good enough. I'll find the chabura from there. I'll be like, wow, that was a real steal. But in the meantime, that's where we're at. So, Vahi Esav ben 40 shana ve'kach isha yudi ba'beiri hachiti ve'basma parilon hachiti. So Esav is 40 years old, and he took a wife for himself, Yehudit, the daughter of Be'eri, and Basmat Bat Elon, who are both from the nation of Chet. Vatiana Murat Ruach Litzak Rivka. And both of them were, and I guess his actions and these women were a source of grief to Yitzhak and Rivka. So the obvious problem with these psukim is that we tend to paint a picture that Yitzchak has this blind affection for Esav. He feels that Esav is truly a tzaddik. Esav married two non-Jewish girls who are bad in the eyes of his father. How could it be that his father is like, oh yeah, it's no big deal? So I guess that's like just the backdrop, which is why we needed those two psukim. So Yitzhak is old, his eyes are weak from seeing, and he calls Esav his older son. So he says, my son, his son answers, you know, he says, Bini, and his son answers, Hineni. And of course, Hineni is that language that we talk about as in, it's really, you know, something special. It shows the willingness to do something great. And there it is. You see that Esav presents himself as a Hineni person. So again, is this a fake out where he really isn't a Hineni person? Is in this moment he is? Why does it tell us that he's Beno HaGadol, the older son? Do we really need to know he's Beno HaGadol? Isn't it obvious? We've been following along closely since the beginning of the parasha, and we know he was born first. So one of the Mefarshim points out, Beno HaGadol, is that he actually was treated and viewed by his father as the older son, meaning there was no question in Yitzhak's mind that what he was about to do was just because Esav was the oldest. That's one possibility. Okay, so what happens? What happens next? Vayomer hinena zakanti lo yadati yomoti. So this is like also, it's a very hard one. So he says, I'm old, and I don't know the day of my death. Now, the big question that we've addressed in the past is, how old is Yitzhak at this point? If he's saying, I don't know when I'm going to die, how old is he? And I guess the question that matters is, how old are the boys? So we know, at a minimum, how old are Yitzhak and Esav at this point in time?
40.
They have to be at least...
Well, I don't know. I mean, yeah, they're at least 40.
But they're at least 40. If they're 40, then how old is their father?
At least 80.
No, he's 60. He's 40 when he gets married. He waits 20 years to have 60. Kids. So
100.
He's 100. So either they're 40 and he's 100 at the minimum, or at the maximum, Rashi says that he's that the boys are 63 and he's 123. Okay, so that's like the range. Now, I guess to say Hinena Zakanti Lo Yadati Yom Moti at 100 is fair, right? Even though his dad was fathering children at 100, so that's not so old, I suppose. But yeah, so why all of a sudden does he feel like he's 100? Let's say he's 123 even. He lives to be 180. He's got another good amount of years. Why is it that all of a sudden he says, I don't know when I'm going to die, so I'm giving you a bracha? So Rashi's answer... Yeah, sorry, someone wants to say something.
I was going to say the fact that says he can't see. Maybe he was concerned that this was a precursor to his demise.
Okay, so I guess you could say that if he just became blind, he could say, like, you know, a blind person is like a dead person, or even if you don't want to go that far, you could just say being blind, he's losing his faculties. So he says, I don't know, maybe this is like where I'm beginning to die, so I want to get the brachos. So Rashi says that he's 123. Rashi's basis for this is the Sefer Seder HaOlam, which tells you the age of everyone. I don't know if anybody remembers from West Hempstead, the professor who used to daven at Anshe. So the professor put out a lot of scholarly works that most people don't read because they just don't understand. There's a person that sits in front
of... Did you buy his Sefer for 25 cents?
No, if they translated it to Hebrew, it's the equivalent. Yeah, so his books, actually, he has in Hebrew. I think it's a translation of the Yerushalmi. It's like Anshe used to have it in the Beis Medrash, which no longer exists. It was like a whole bookshelf in there, and I don't know. I can't imagine very many people understood it. Anyway, there's a guy that sits in front of me in Shul who has a Sefer, the translation of the Seder Olam by the professor. So, like, it made good conversation when we first made Aliyah. So either that guy is incredibly scholarly, or, I don't know, he's got, like, a book that's, you know, just on a different level. So, yeah. That's the Seder HaOlam. Rashi tends to hold that the Seder HaOlam is the correct age for people. So he said that the Seder HaOlam says that he's 123, right? Why? Because he works backwards and says that Rivka was born at the Akedah. At the Akedah, how old was... he would have been 60... Second, at the Akedah, he would have been, okay, let's work backwards. He would have been 33 at the 37, thank you, at the Akedah. David, you're right. We're much sharper at 12 o'clock in the afternoon. He would have been 37 because his mom was 127, and that's when Rivka was born. Because we're told right afterwards that Rivka was born. So 37, how old was Rivka when she got married? She was three because she had to be royal Labia. Okay, so that takes you to 40. And now work everything from there. 40. So he, you know, that's how old he was at the Akedah. So, okay, fine. But that doesn't answer why. Sorry.
Missing the 23 years.
Yeah, that still doesn't explain why he gets up to there. So he says, he then works backwards from Mechiras Yosef, and says, Mechiras Yosef Yaakov is... 108, he just works backwards. So the math in my head is a little bit like fuzzy, but however it is, he comes out that would lead you to have the boys be at 63 years old. The pshat should be that they're 40. It's like, right? It's Smichas Parshios, he's 40. And then the next pasuk is Vayiki Zaken Yitzchak. Okay, so Lo Yadati Yomoti, so Rashi says he's 123, which is within 5 years of the death of his mother. And whatever age your parents die, 5 years before that, on both ends, meaning if one parent lives to be 105 and the other one lives to be, I don't know, 75. So then you have to be choshesh at both of those times. Oh my gosh, I'm within Yom HaMita. So he says because he's within 5 years, which is really 4 years, of the day of the death of Sarah, he says, Lo Yadati Yom Moti. That's Rashi. Okay. So that's like, that's fine. Yeah.
More comment. Is it going back a pasuk, half a pasuk? So B'no HaGadol, is it possible that the Torah is telling us, just repeating the fact that, because this is Yitzchak's perspective on Esav, that he's just confirming for us, he still doesn't know that the Bechorah was sold?
Okay, so that's interesting. That you could say that, right? Like, I think that's generally how we learn it, is that Yitzchak is completely oblivious. He does not know what happened between his two sons, and Rivka does. So Rivka is kind of moving all the pieces to ensure that the right person gets the bracha, and Beno Agadol, he has no idea. So the Chizkuni says something that is absolutely crazy, because he says the exact opposite of what David just said. So David, you set that up perfectly. He says, why does he say Beno Agadol? He says, I'm giving you the bracha because I know that you deserve it. And even though you sold the brachos, I still think that you're worthy of getting the bracha. It's pretty wild.
That's why it says Beno Agadol. It could have said Esav Bechoro, but it doesn't.
Right. He says, you are the Beno Agadol and you are going to get the Bechoro, but I have a problem. You see, because you sold it, if we wait for the transfer of the bracha till I die, which means that the bracha actually didn't have to really be transferred. It's just a concept that's going to go to the Bechor automatically. He says, if I wait till I die, the way the inheritance would work is it would just automatically go to you because you're the Bechor. So how do I beat that? Living will, right? I give it to you while I'm still alive, and then it supersedes it, right? Like, how do you can get around the halachically, the Bechor is entitled to Pishnayim. Nowadays, a lot of parents don't want to do that because, like, you don't want to create tension that the oldest son gets more of the inheritance. So you give it out. You can set up a will that it gives it out the moment before death. And at that point in time, if you decide you want to give everything to one person, you know, as long as you're mentally, you're mentally clear, that's fine. So that's what the Chizkuni is saying. He's saying that Yitzhak wanted the brachos to go to Esav, and the only way to give it to him was if he gave it to him prior to his death. It's pretty wild. So, I mean, again, the three things that I kind of want to try to figure out is, or so far two, why can't Yitzchak see, and why does he choose Esav? So what happens? And he says, "Vatasana keilecha tal yochav kashtecha otzeh sadev tzud litzayit. Go out to the field with all your weapons. Vaseli matamim kasher hafti. Make me the food that I like. Vaviyali vochela bavort tevarechecha nafshi betar mamut. And then I'll give you a bracha before I die. Rivka shomat. Rivka hears this and bedaber Yitzchak leEsav beno." And Esav goes out to the field to go hunting. And Rivka says to Yaakov, her son, saying, I heard your father speaking to your brother Esav, saying, quickly get me food so I can give you a bracha before I die. And now I ask you, my son, to listen to my voice and do what? You're going to go get me two goats. Right? So why goats? If Esav is going to get deer, Rashi says, I'm only telling you this because I found something fascinating on the internet that I thought was helpful. Rashi says that why goats? Because goats taste like deer. So we had this discussion years ago when I suggested that the following year, Parshas Toldos, Jeremy should get us a goat for the chabura food. And he spoke to Yitzchaki, and David Yitzchaki said that goat tastes disgusting and nobody would eat it. And nobody says that about deer. So it's interesting. I actually found...
First of all, the whole debate about what is the deer. Did we learn about that in the Biblical Museum?
It could be.
We're not sure what's the tzvi in the aisle and some of the other animals.
Could be. I've been there twice and don't remember, but that's not, you know, surprising. So there is a, I found an article online. I don't know, it's sort of anybody that is following the Navi thing. It's sort of like when I found how to capture foxes. It's not biblical sources, but some guy does a an analysis between deer and goat and what they have in common. And apparently they're both very gamey, which I don't know what that means, but he must have said that at least 10 times in the article. And he actually says that they do taste surprisingly similar, so in many ways. So,
Amy, I've had deer.
Yeah,
and I thought it was more like spice, a little on the spicy side.
They're both very tough.
Okay, Matty, are you saying from experience you've eaten goat?
No, I haven't eaten goat, but that's what they mean by gaming.
Oh, okay, fine, thank you, I appreciate that. I thought you were, like, you said it with like such like, like it was so
one's cheaper than the other.
I assume goat is cheaper.
They get plenty of goat, but they don't get any deer.
It's easier to catch a goat than a deer.
Which is exactly why it takes Yaakov a lot less time than his brother. But anyway, I thought that was interesting for what it's worth. Okay, so why is Rivka running interference? Why is she so set on Yaakov getting the brachot? And then the last question I want to ask, I think it's an interesting question that we don't really have much to base this answer on. Sometimes if Hirsch gives answers that you wonder where he gets them from, this is definitely one of them. I mean, he says it's alluded slightly in the Pasuk, but the question is, did the two of them ever talk about this? Did Rivka and Yitzhak ever have a conversation where they're like, listen, you're going to die at some point. Who are you going to give the brachos to?
Did they have any conversations at all?
Yeah, okay, so that's true. That's another question. And again, using using Tanakh as a proof to that is very hard, because Avram and Sarah seem to have a pretty good marriage, and how much do they really say to each other in Tanakh? Not much. Honey, you're my sister, right? I don't know. And why, you know, why did you laugh? There's not a whole lot of other conversations.
Go make a meal for the guests. I mean, they have a whole bunch of conversations.
Right. So, I don't know if I could think of that much more than that. But, okay, so that's, again, just the fact that they don't talk is not enough of a reason, but, you know, in the text. But, again, it's a good question, you know, both in this regard and David's question as a broader question. Okay, so let's take a look now at Rashi. Rashi says, "Vatichena, his eyes were weakened." Bashanan shel elu shayu mashnod matirot avodah zara, that from the smoke of these women who would bring sacrifices to avodah zara. Davar acher, kishneket al gabi mizbeach vayaviv rotzel shachto, when he was on the mizbeach. And and his father wanted to shech to him. So the heavens opened up. He saw the heavens open up. And they cried. And the tears went into his eyes, which is unbelievable. The precision of those.
Is he claiming hysterical blindness?
I don't know. I mean, Rashi seems to, it's a spiritual tear that falls from the heavens that blinds him. So I'll just say that yesterday, I really wanted more information on Lo Yadati Yom Moti, because that really bothered me more than anything else in all these psukim. So I took any sefer I thought might have it. And I opened up Hegyona Shel Torah, which is Rabbi Ben Zion Fearer. And his question really is, like, he doesn't have anything on Lo Yadati Yom Moti, but he has an entire article dedicated to these tears that fall from heaven. So Bli Neder, next year, that's our chabura. It's a wild idea he has. But again, what does that mean? That tears from heaven fall in there? Lefichach kahu einav, and that's why he turned blind. Davar acher, k'dei sheyutol Yaakov et habrachot. So the third answer is so that Yaakov could actually take the brachos. Now the question also is, when did this happen? See, the timeline according to each of these answers would be different. According to the first pshat, how old was Yitzhak when he became blind? Okay, what event had to happen first?
Esau had to get married.
Okay, so Esau got married at 40, means he has to be a minimum of 100. Now, maybe right away, they were frummer, and then as time went on, their true colors showed. But somewhere after he's 100 years old, he was blind. According to the second explanation, when should he have turned blind?
37.
Right, unless there is something like these tears, you know, have a slow time release.
And only reaction, right,
only years later does he go blind from it. And then the third answer is he goes blind so that Yaakov can get the brachos. According to that, when could he have turned blind?
Yesterday.
Yeah. So all of these present us with a pretty crazy timeline that's pretty all over the place. So let's take a look at L'Pshuto Shel Rashi. So he says like this, Asibash harishona bashan shel elu nilmed that mismichot anyanim v'tiena murat ruach shepasak hakodem le'goreim v'tichan einav. He says that it's the women. And why do I know that? Because that's right before he turns blind, what happens? They're introduced into the household. That's his first explanation. Asibash niya m'bereshes rabba nirmezeh b'limila mira'ot. It doesn't say, it doesn't say he couldn't see. That's what it says by Yaakov. That's what it says by Eliyahu Kohen. That's what it says by Achiyahu. Kolomer me'ra'ot machmat oto re'iya. He saw something that made him unable to see. But it's vatichena inav me'ra'ot. His eyes became weakened from this vision that he had of these angels. Machmarot, okay, sharuma achlim, shagarmeloshago enav. Hasibash li shitche maybe Rashi. The third answer that Rashi gives is meshiva la sheila lama kahu enav. Why? Why did he have to become blind? Whereas the first two are how? All right, I don't know if it was worth buying a 5-volume set when I was in sixth grade just for that. But I felt good putting in Mechabura. Okay, so
the truth is that the language itself is a little bizarre, even for Chumash. Batichena is an interesting way of explaining blindness.
Right, I think by the others, this is Kavdu Einav Mezoken.
Right.
Isn't Leia,
Batichena, Kehed, means they darken. This dark.
Right, he's not totally blind. He's like,
right,
I don't know, macular degeneration.
Turned a blind eye.
Okay.
Yeah.
Could be.
Language for Leia,
but
it said her eyes were
Rakos.
I don't know, never mind.
Okay.
Kehet literally means darkened.
Okay. So I guess here's my question to you. We have three answers of Rashi. Is there one you prefer over the other? Is there, or maybe a better question,
well,
is which one do you think is more pshat?
One's a Y.
There's only two. One's right. I like the third because the third is tachlis.
Right. Okay, but right. So it's the Y.
That's not necessarily a reason. It's, I mean,
this has to happen.
Well, I like the first answer better.
You like the first answer. Why?
Because it's more reasonable.
Okay. I mean, I like the third
timing. It's like it's having an effect on his vision in his later years, and it's close to the timing of the event that we're talking about.
Right. So I personally think the third answer is the one that gives us. I know you're not.
No, the third's a why. It's not a how.
Right, but I'm saying I think the important piece is why. Like, what happens that this blindness is important? So you want to say he's disappointed with the wives, it's great, but really this is a function of he needs to be able to be blind in order so that Yaakov can get the brachos. Now, honestly, if you read this pasuk, can you come up with your own pshat for why he became blind? Vahiki zaken yitzchak vatichana einav
mirot. Yeah, part of getting old.
Right, so take a look at the Rashbam. The Rashbam says that tichena inav min hazkena, kmo she matzino b'sefer Shmuel veinav hechilu kehot. Right, Eli's old, and his eyesight starts to go. Right, it's a chiddush when someone who's our age loses their sight. When someone who's 95 loses their sight, it's like not uncommon, probably a decent amount of the people in any one of the old age homes or whatever they call them that are politically correct, right? Like assisted living homes, right? A lot of them can't see. I don't know. They make bingo boards that are about that big with numbers that are about that big. So, and you can still play. You can still play bingo. So that's really the Rashbam seems to just be a much better answer. Like, why can't we just accept that that's the answer? So now let's take a look at the Sfarno. The Sfarno says, "Kmo shekara la eli shalomicha bebanav kamro lo kehabam." He didn't tell his sons off, and therefore what happens? His eyes go. Velo kara zel Avram v'Yaakov. This doesn't happen to Avram or Yaakov. Shayu yoteres keni mashaya yitzlak as mashaya eli. Avram and Yaakov were much older than Yitzchak, and they didn't lose their sight. But Avram k'tiv vayosef Avram ikach isha v'Yaakov in kol tzaratav. No, vayar yisal b'nei Yosef al pi shaya ro'eh b'kovid kamru v'nei yisal kavdu mezokin b'ofen shel akira tmuna pratit. So it sounds like, according to the Sfarno, why does this all happen? Because Yitzhak does not tell off his sons. If he had told off his sons, he would not have lost his vision. Okay? The Me'ena Shel Torah takes it one step further and says, if you don't purge evil from your home, evil will purge you. We see that nowadays. It says, Yishmael was banished. Yitzhak does not banish Esav. Yitzhak thrives. What does Yaakov ultimately have to do? Yaakov has to run away because Esav has his place rooted in the home. That is the Me'ena Shel Torah. Okay, let's take a look at the... I guess we're running out of time, so we'll skip Rabbeinu Bachaye. I'll tell you outside pretty much what he says, is that he does not perceive evil properly. That's really where it is, which could mean that he's not really totally blind, but he's blinded to the situation, and this could explain why he miscalculates with Esav as well. Okay, Rabbeinu Bachaye says, "Ayideh shenatal shochad me'Esav kahu einav," because he took bribes from his son, I guess by way of the food that he's given. Dechtiv ki hashochad ya'aver. Right, because bribes blind people. Okay, so that's Rabbeinu Bachaye. Those are all of our explanations. The Rav Hirsch. We're not going to look at Rav Hirsch inside because I still want to share with you an idea by Rabbi Lam. But Rav Hirsch says the following. He says, why does he say hinei na zakanti? He don't need to say na zakanti. So he says actually that... he had decided a long time ago that he was going to give the bracha to Esav. Problem was that Rivka constantly had this conversation with him, and every time the conversation came up, what happens? She says, it's a bad idea, but you're not old. You're still plenty, you have plenty of life left. Let's see how everything plays itself out. Maybe Esav will be deserving of it ultimately, but right now he's not. So what Yitzhak does is, Yitzhak actually, by saying hinei na zakanti, he's calling Esav, he's saying, you know, I've had this conversation, I've gone back and forth, and now I know that my time is near, and I want to give you this bracha. He's doing this against the will and against the conversation that he had with his wife. So the question, though, that Rav Hirsch asks is, halfway through, why would he want to do this? Right? Why would he want to give it to him? So he suggested it's possible that Esav was masquerading himself as an Ishtam, and in this, that's the deception that Esav pulls on him. And so what is dresses him up and then, you know, whatever, that's the plan. And then he ends up by saying, he's really shaken at the end because he realizes how badly he had been deceived by Esav. So that's a Hirsch. Okay, so I think we answered up all of our questions. Why can't he see? To me, the simplest explanation is the Rashbam. He's just old. And then maybe that ties into the third answer of Rashi, and that allows Yaakov to get the brachos. And perhaps if Hirsch is explaining the tension that exists in the home, both between the brothers, both between the sons and their father, and between the husband and wife.
You know, it almost sets it up for a Mida Keneged Mida kind of situation.
Okay.
You know, he buys into all this trickery, and then he ends up getting...
He gets tricked himself.
Himself, pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. So, Rabbi Lam actually has a good question. He says, like, what... When he gave his drasha right after the Cuban Missile Crisis. So he says, like, we just stared at the abyss. We thought that the world was going to be destroyed. What's our reaction supposed to be when something like this happens? Something so cataclysmic. What's our response supposed to be? So he says the following. He says that there's two reactions to that. Two people in our parsha confront death. And how do they respond? It's Yitzchak and it's Esav. Yitzchak acknowledges that his time has come. He's really at the end. He's going to die. And he has to make a decision. What do you do when you're at that point in your life? What?
Except he's wrong. He's not that close to death.
Well, I mean, it's funny that you say that because you can make the same argument. Esav stares death in the eye when he thinks he's going to die after a day in the field and he's famished and there's no food. And man...
Right. He didn't really think that.
Right. So, they're both wrong, right? They both express that they're going to die. So, Rabbi Lam says when one is confronted with death, one has to make a decision what they're going to do. And the parsha really gives us the answer what one can do. Yitzhak says, "I'm going to die. What do I need to do? I need to be worried about my legacy." So, in his what he thinks are potentially his final moments. He looks to teach, and he looks to bless. And of course, this is like the Jewish model throughout Tanakh. Yaakov is about to die. He sits and he blesses his sons. And he actually, his timing, or his assessment of the timing is much better. And Moshe Rabbeinu does that also on the day of his death. Esav looks death in the eye and says, well, there won't be a tomorrow anyway, so I might as well eat, drink, and be merry. Rabbi Lam gives an amazing analogy to it. He says, life is like a postcard. You have a certain amount of room to write on. At the beginning, what does one do? So one takes the postcard and they write in big letters. And then they all of a sudden they get, you know, it's hard for us to like, the analogy is sort of lost on our generation because email is endless. You could write paragraphs and paragraphs. But he's writing and you write and write and write. And as you get to the end and you see, wait, I have so much more to do, but there's so little space. You have to try to squeeze it all in. He says that that is really how life is. Yitzhak and Esav both realize they're at the end, but each of them try to stuff in a different thing. Whereas Esav puts in physical stuff. And this is, I just got to eat, I got to drink. Yeah, Yitzhak does something much more meaningful and much more long-lasting. I thought that perhaps the whole story then could explain, according to Rabbi Lam, he does not say this, why Yitzhak chooses Esav. It's his last effort to do what? To educate Esav. You see, we know that he does not give Birchat Avraham to Esav. That he saves to give to Yaakov. He always planned on making Yaakov into the next Av, according to most explanations. But he felt like if I sit with my son Esav, maybe, there's a possibility that I could turn him around. I can give him something. And maybe that actually breathes a little bit of positivity into the Chizkuni. The Chizkuni who says, B'no Agadol, he says, I know I'm about to die. And I know that you don't deserve the bracha because you sold it. He's acknowledging, Esav, I know who you really are, but I'm hopeful that in this last encounter, if I infuse you with spirituality and perhaps I show you what one is supposed to do at the end of life, now what you did when you were at the end of your life, perhaps that would educate and turn Esav. All right. Have a wonderful Shabbos, everyone.